This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning and welcome to the show. You're with Julian Ng, Wong Xiaoning and Sharitz Abdullah on this 30th of August, 7:06 a.m. U.S. equities rallied last night after China said that it wouldn't immediately retaliate against the latest American tariff rise. Treasuries edged down while the dollar gauge hit a two-year high. And the U.S. stock markets were performed very well, rather. S&P 500 Dow Jones together with NASDAQ closed up sharply of more than 1%, between 1.3% to 1.5%.
Yeah, so the S&P rose for the second day, for the second straight day. After you're looking at the spokesperson for China Commerce Ministry, he said that escalating the trade war won't benefit either side and that it was more important to discuss removing the extra tariff duties.
Meanwhile, stocks across Asia trimmed declines on the remarks, while the stocks Europe 600 index also closed higher. Market sentiment remained, however, delicate after President Donald Trump's recent pronouncements on trade. And as investors await resolution, Trump said yesterday that the US and China are scheduled to have a conversation about trade today. Meanwhile, if we look at US GDP, economic growth slowed in the second quarter by more than initially reported on weaker readings for categories including exports and inventories.
We have Carlos Casanova online, his chief Asia economist of COFASA, to help us unravel some of this development across the world. And good morning, Carlos, and thanks for joining us. So we see that the U.S. is trying to issue some ultra-long U.S. bonds. I think ultra-long is longer than 30 years, which is the bond tenure that they have right now. What does this mean for the global treasury markets, as well as whether investors would warm up to this issue?
Good morning. So they have floated the idea of issuing ultra-long bonds before for a number of years already. And it does seem now like the demand side of the conditions is improved. So we've seen a lot of investors flocking to bonds, you know, as they have concerns about global recession, trade wars, etc. So there's been a lot of demand for especially those short-term 10 years. So they would potentially want to, through the issuance of this long, ultra-long-term bond, to sort of shift some of that demand towards longer 10 years and try to invert that bond yield inversion and to reverse that inversion going forward. However, why would the U.S. want to finance its long-term investments and pay more for it when already the sort of premiums that they're paying for this capital inflow are so low, right? So to me, it points to something else, perhaps something on the financing of the yawning government deficit front. The Trump administration is definitely trying to do more to invest and to expand that fiscal deficit, and they just need money to do so.
And Carlos, the Chinese yuan hit an 11-year low this week. Has the currency been weaponized in this trade war, and how much further would Beijing allow it to weaken?
So in our opinion, the currency is not being weaponized, but it is reacting naturally to sort of external shocks to the economy. Remember, the Chinese government does intervene in foreign exchange markets, but not to depreciate the value of the currency. In recent years, it's been more to support the value of the currency to avoid capital outflows. So as the economy slows and it becomes quite expensive to intervene, it's normal that the government would allow that currency to depreciate slightly. It does help to improve terms of trade, but if they go too far, so we are penciling in a 7.1 this year, if they go too far, that would trigger capital outflows. So they can't really weaponize it fully.
And Carlos, the Bank of Korea cut rates to 1.5 in July, so there doesn't appear to be much room for further cuts, right, to avert a slowdown. But they've also announced the most expansionary budget since the financial crisis of 2008. Would that be enough to overcome the impact of a global slowdown and the trade spat with Japan?
Exactly. So some concerns potentially in Korea, because they did announce a very aggressive fiscal budget at the beginning of the year. And they were banking on the fact that together with an increase in the minimum wage to support consumption would be enough to stimulate the economy this year. It hasn't really panned out that way, because the minimum wage increase just didn't transfer into an increase in consumption. And of course, they were not foreseeing this problem with Japan. So unfortunately, in our opinion, they do not have much room to cut, but there might not be any other way going forward than another rate cut in the fourth quarter. Going into 2020 is a different story, and they will have to find a new growth driver. But so far, it seems that they are going to have a little bit of pressure in the fourth quarter to boost growth.
And with protests in Hong Kong continuing and turning more violent, retail sales, which will be released later today, is expected to be lower than the 6.7 registered in June. Even luxury brands like Tiffany's are warning of weaker sales as a result. How much worse could things get in Hong Kong?
Well, we currently believe that the sort of things are going to get worse, first of all. We have seen weak performance throughout the region, especially in small trade-oriented economies like Hong Kong and Singapore in the first half. So growth in the first half dropped to 0.6%, and that triggered even the local regulator to downgrade its growth forecast for the year quite significantly. Now, this weakness is factoring in a lot of the sort of contraction in exports, but not so far on domestic demand. Retail sales did sort of start to trickle down as, you know, income levels fall with this ongoing trade war, but it's not really picking up the sharp contraction that we will see as a result of, you know, the fact that commercial arteries were closed due to the protests in July and August. So we do expect things to get a little bit worse in Q3 before that fiscal package that they just announced 2 weeks ago kicks in Q4. So I think we are going to see a deceleration in Q3 and then a slight recovery in Q4 as a result of fiscal stimulus.
Thank you so much for your time. And that was Carlos Casanova, Chief Asia Economist of COFAS. Interesting that he said that it's hard to weaponize the Chinese yuan because it usually takes a life of its own. And the Chinese government has so far intervening in the market and not actually weakening the yuan. There is a difference between the two.
Well, they do set the benchmark rate every day at 9 a.m. And then there's a little spread that the currency can trade at. So they have been keeping a close eye on where the yuan is. But it's not. There's no denying it's still at an 11-year low. But I think they're very mindful of it, as what Carlos pointed out. If it continues to depreciate, the risk, of course, is capital outflow out of China.
That's right.
Okay, in other news, Saudi Aramco considering a plan for dual listing. This is supposedly one of the biggest IPOs in the world. Apparently, they are leaning towards Tokyo, according to some sources.
Yeah, this is because there's of the political uncertainty in the UK and China reducing the appeal of London and Hong Kong's market. And, you know, it would be a disappointment for London and Hong Kong. Initially, it has been the most likely location for the listing.
Yeah, I think this Wall Street Journal story, which says Tokyo, is a complete surprise to me because this was never even in the radar when news that Aramco was going to list, right?
I mean, totally surprising.
Totally. I was like, New York, London maybe. There was even talk of Hong Kong, Singapore, but Tokyo, this is an unusual pick for them if it does happen.
Yeah, I would understand the thing about London and Hong Kong because of Brexit and the crisis in Hong Kong right now. But the US would be a more likely candidate because they understand oil there. They have a lot of large oil companies that are listed over there. I'm not sure what Japan's selling point is.
I mean, on top of it, US is still the center for institutional funds, right? That's where most of the money is, where the dry powder is. So being in New York would definitely give you the attention that you want and that you need. Tokyo, this is an interesting choice.
And there was a news, even a Norway sovereign fund are moving about $1 trillion of their a lot of their capital from Europe transferring to the US as a result. So it's quite a surprise.
Well, I think this would be a good candidate to be included in the Norway fund's portfolio because the listing size, the earnings is about $111 billion. You know how we talk about the Norway fund being the biggest fund in the world is running out of stocks to buy.
But
right?
They're not supposed to buy any more oil. Oh,
that's right. That's right. They are the oil fund to start off with. Now they're excluding this.
Yeah,
excluding this.
They don't even buy any more emerging market bonds. So their universe is getting smaller and smaller by the day, which is an irony when they're $1.4 trillion US dollars.
And also, I think the Hong Kong situation is interesting because they're also considering dual class shares to open that up to attract the Alibaba listing number two. This would be a blow in their face, isn't it?
Yeah, but the Alibaba listing has been pushed back also because of all these protests. Capital markets there haven't been the best. I think there won't be so much appetite for Alibaba at this current moment.
I think one of the things is looking at the role of Aramco for Saudi Arabia. They are the sole, revenue for the government to do a lot of things. That they are moving away from oil, as we know, and putting a lot of money in tech, really. And they have one of those citizens called Sophia, the AI citizen of Saudi Arabia.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. I mean, the Saudi Arabia is clearly too oil dependent, right? So they have been trying to diversify, and one of which is to try to encourage a middle class population, a consuming population. But it's going to be a very difficult transition. I mean, listing Aramco is part of that exercise. Actually, they're only listing 5% of this company, guys. So it's very tiny compared to what the whole Aramco does. It's also the most profitable company in the world. We saw that when they did a bond and the prospectus revealed, I can't remember how much money they made, billion. US dollars, right? Profit, that's like staggering.
Mm-hmm. I think that even if you're listing 5% of a company, it's a good move for them because they are opening up themselves to more international investor scrutiny, and that will keep you in check. Because if you're a government that is very powerful in control of such vast resources of the country, you need some check and balance there, and listing is a good way to do that, I think.
So you think Petronas should be listed then, Julian?
Petronas actually has listings of a lot of their subsidiaries. I'm not sure if the national oil company themselves should be listed. I don't know, because they're usually, as we will cover later, right, there's a lot of national interests involved.
Exactly.
All right, we're taking a break right now and coming back with more news after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.